This is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman. The recent arrest of a top Huawei executive in Canada has put a spotlight again on the Chinese telecommunications giant. Huawei is target of U.S. security agencies, yet the Chinese telecommunications firm recently passed Apple as the number two seller of smartphones worldwide and is in a race to build out the next generation of wireless network known as 5G. Canada arrested Huawei's CFO, Mengwan Zhou. She faces possible extradition to the United States after a bail hearing later on today. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the case was based strictly on legal criteria, not political ones.
I can assure everyone that we are a country of an independent judiciary, and the appropriate authorities took the decisions in this case without any political involvement or interference, as must be the case.
News reports say Meng is suspected of trying to evade U.S. sanctions against Iran. Former U.S. FBI Director James Comey set to testify before a congressional committee today after months of resisting their request to do so. The committee subpoenaed Comey to testify about investigations into the Trump campaign's alleged ties to Russia and President Trump's opponent Hillary Clinton's emails during the time leading up to the 2016 U.S. election. President Trump will be naming State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert as the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. That's the word. The announcement expected later today. Nauert came to the State Department after a stint at Fox News as an anchor and correspondent, where, according to the State Department biography, she covered global and domestic crises. This is VOA News. North Korean efforts to upgrade and expand a long-range missile base came as no surprise to U.S. intelligence officials. New satellite imagery shows what appears to be improvements to a missile base located in North Korea's mountainous interior, as well as the work on a new facility 11 kilometers away. Yemen's warring sides agree to free thousands of prisoners in what a UN mediator called a hopeful start to the first peace talks in years to end a war that has pushed millions of people to the verge of starvation. Reuters' Emily Wither reporting.
Just getting the two sides to the table was a milestone, but they also agreed to free thousands of prisoners in what the UN mediator described as a hopeful start.
This is a huge tribute to those here present, and of enormous importance to the many, many thousands of families who seek the return to them of those currently lost to them.
The UN mediator wants a deal on reopening the capital's airport, shoring up the central bank, and securing a truce in Hodeidah, the country's main port. Currently held by the Houthis, the coalition launched a campaign to capture it this year. This could then lead to a wider ceasefire.
It is Reuters' Emily Wither reporting. There was a final farewell Thursday for former U.S. President George H.W. Bush after a memorial service in Washington Wednesday at an Episcopal church in Houston on Thursday, where the Bush family worshipped for nearly 50 years. The former president's grandson, George P. Bush, said his grandfather was the most gracious, most decent, and humble man he'd ever known.
Today, after 94 years, the heavy hand of time has claimed the life of my Gamps. But in death as in life, my grandfather has won, for he has exchanged his earthly burdens for a heavenly home and is at peace.
President Bush's friend and former Secretary of State James Baker barely held back tears as he paid tribute to his former boss and longtime friend.
We rejoice, Mr. President, that you are safely tucked in now and through the ages with God's loving arms around you, because our glory, George, was to have had you as our president and as such a friend.
Former president's body was then taken by train to Texas A&M University, the location of his presidential library. Mr. Bush was laid to rest there in a private ceremony next to his wife of 73 years, Barbara Bush, who died earlier this year, and their daughter, Robin, who died of leukemia as a child. I'm Steve Norman, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Friday, December 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Togolese government has banned protests planned for this Saturday and beyond, but the opposition is defiant.
Whatever we do it peacefully. So they don't have the right to tell us that we should not do that unless they themselves want to use violence.
Bridget Ajamabo-Johnson is coordinator of Togo's main opposition coalition. Zambia's opposition says it will hold a nationwide protest against President Edgar Lungu's decision to increase cabinet ministers' salaries. A British lawyer is rebuffed to practice law in Kenya. And a Guinean opposition leader is on a hunger strike to support striking teachers.
We have decided to start a hunger strike since yesterday to call the attention of the president and the government so that they can actually accept to negotiate for the children to go back to school.
Faya Mulimuno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. A new report says Mali's population needs to speak out more in support of services. And Zimbabwe sets aside millions of dollars to compensate displaced white farmers. The stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A coalition of 14 opposition political parties in Togo says it will go ahead with Saturday's planned protest against the December 20th legislative elections, despite a government ban on such protests. The opposition is boycotting the election until the Togolese government can institute necessary constitutional reforms. The Minister for Territorial Administration said yesterday, Thursday, that the protests would interfere with political rallies and campaigns. But Bridget Ajamabo-Johnson, the coordinator of Togo's main opposition coalition, says the protests will go ahead tomorrow as planned because the opposition has a constitutional right to protest.
We think that this is a violation of one of our fundamental rights. We are legal political parties. And we have the right as church to have a program to campaign when in the country they decide to organize an election, even if we don't agree with the decision to organize this election. This is our right to campaign against the election.
So what do you think about what the government says? The Minister for Territorial Administration, he says that the caravans in your procession, your protest procession, will clash with those of the political parties that are participating in the coming legislative election.
We think that often we've had very peaceful protests and we have peaceful meetings. Whatever we do it peacefully. So they don't have the right to tell us that we should not do that. Unless they themselves want to use violence.
That's the fear. So what is the opposition going to do, Bridget?
We will not respect what they've said. We consider that because it is our right, we will keep on having our program. You know, today, for example, what we decided to have was to go through the country and try to raise awareness. But because they wanted to prevent us from doing this, they came very early. They went to block the headquarters of my party, that's to use as the 14 political parties' headquarters. But we just decided to have an alternate plan. We went to another party headquarters and we organized from there to have our activity. That's what we did. We did it because we know this is our right.
So, therefore, your protest that was scheduled for Saturday, do you still intend to carry that out?
Exactly. We will do it. We will.
Bridget, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Bridget Ajamagbo Johnson is coordinator of Togo's main opposition coalition. She was speaking with me from the capital, Lome. Two Zambian opposition parties have notified the police of their planned nationwide protest against President Edgar Lungu's decision to increase the salaries of cabinet ministers. The pay raise means that cabinet ministers will earn about $3,468 per month. But Hakainde Hichilema of the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, and Chishimba Kambwili of the National Democratic Congress Party say the 100% salary and allowance increases of cabinet ministers and the president are illegal. Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for the opposition UPND.
They have notified the police that we intend to carry out a peaceful demonstration against President of the Republic of Zambia for awarding himself and his ministers 100% salary increment. This has come at a time when the same government, the same president, refused to award civil servant a reasonable salary increment. He could only give them 5% to 10%. But after that, he has awarded himself 100% salary increment and his ministers. And they've backdated that salary increment award to January this year. So they will get in arrears for 12 months. And this is coming at a time when this economy is struggling, shortages of medicines, money to pay even farmers and so on. Everything is grinding to a halt.
Isn't it the prerogative of the president to increase salary of public sector workers of which they are part of?
He can increase, but the increase must be reasonable and it must be across the board. But in this case, it was motivated by selfishness. He was only interested in increasing his salary by 100%, but all other hardworking workers in the public service, he refused to give them a reasonable amount. He told them there's no money. That is unfair and unacceptable.
Your leader, Hakainde Hichilema, as well as Chishimba Kambwili, both said the decision to award himself a 100% increment that you described is illegal. But some are also saying if it is illegal, why not seek redress in court rather than go in the streets?
Well, not everybody can go to court, and the court processes in Zambia can take years and years. So we want to stop it by peacefully demonstrating to give our message, our displeasure to the government that we are not happy. Yes, it is illegal because an increment to be effected, or indeed, it must have the approval of parliament. And they never went to parliament to seek approval. They just awarded themselves outside parliamentary procedures.
Some are saying that your planned protest is just a political stunt, just to tarnish the reputation and the image of the ruling party to score political points.
The ruling party and this government are embarrassing themselves. It's not us that are embarrassing them. It's their own actions that are embarrassing the government and the ruling party. We cannot sit by and watch them plunder the country's resources through unreasonable salaries and allowances at a time when everybody else has been told there's no money and must tighten their belts. So we must tighten the belts together with the leaders, not just the ordinary workers.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. A Guinean opposition leader is on a four-day hunger strike to support striking teachers' demand for an $800 a year salary increase. Meanwhile, students have been out of school as the strike continues. The government of President Alpha Conde has said it will not negotiate with teachers because their demand is unaffordable. Has deployed the military to stop violence and demonstrations. Faya Milimunu, leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea, has said his hunger strike is intended to force the government to negotiate with the teachers.
It has been more than 2 months now. Students are not going to school. And the government doesn't want to negotiate with the union, pretending that what the union is asking is too much. And what we've been seeing also from the president and from the government is they decide to finance everything else, sending children to dance, like to tell them we have money to send you dancing, but we don't have money to pay your teachers to send you to school. So that's why my political party that I'm leading, the Bloc Liberal, we have decided to start a hunger strike to call the attention of the president and the government so that they can actually accept to negotiate for the children to go back to school.
What exactly do the teachers want?
The teachers are asking to be paid something like $1 million. $1 million is actually about the equivalent of $900. So the government is saying that that's too much, that they cannot even start negotiating. And that's why for the last 2 months, schools are not opened and children are not going to school.
The government would say the teachers have a responsibility to teach the students. Whether or not the government meets their demand, they have the right to be in the classroom to teach the students.
Yes. I mean, things doesn't work that way here because the problem has been going on between the union and the government for the last 2 years. Every time they sit to talk, the government keep giving promises without doing what they decided to do. So at this point, for the union people, they don't want just the government to say, we are going to do this. They want something concrete for them to go back to school and teach the children.
Fayamili Munu is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with me from the capital, Conakry. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 7th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. The Malian population should be the strongest voices when it comes to services and needs in the region, says a new report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Aurelien Toby, co-author of the report, spoke to Ricky Stryak about their findings in the country that has been in democratic crisis since a rebellion in 2012.
What we find in our study is that Malians actually expect the state to perform very well in providing services to the population. But because they don't find these services at the local level, they actually resort to other means. And sometimes they actually reach out to other organizations or they create these services for themselves. And so in that sense, that's a sense of resilience.
Is it also leave them more susceptible to groups that would come in and provide services in exchange for militant services from the youth? I know sometimes this has been a method of jihadi groups to also recruit members because they provide the services that the government does not.
Yeah, what we find is that the population then reaches out to different organizations to provide the services. And it can be armed groups, but it can be also civilian groups. They can actually organize themselves within the community to provide basic services to the population. And yes, sometimes jihadi groups or armed groups can actually replace the state in certain parts of the country.
Part of the international response is often to try and get these countries to have models that Western countries do, that the U.S. does, that France does, with a strong central government, one could say. But do you think that there is a need for international partners to look at different ways of providing services when it comes to decentralization?
So it's a complicated answer, actually, to this question. Because in a way, what we find is that Malians actually have a lot of expectations of the central state to provide the services. Yet the central state doesn't provide the services they need. So in a way, the central state has to also listen to the needs of the population and actually insert themselves into the local context, actually, and respond to needs rather than provide an offer of services.
What about the tensions between northern Mali and southern Mali and this the fact that the country itself is made up is of a wide variety of ethnic groups and a wide variety of backgrounds?
There is this sense in Mali that there is a divide between the north and the south. But what we find as well is that there are actually regional differences. The needs in the south of the country, in the center of the country, in the north of the country are very different. And so in a way, it's very, very difficult for the state to have one national policy to provide services over the entire territory. And so what it needs is actually to adapt its offer of services to the various needs regionally as expressed by the population.
That was Aurelien Toby, co-author of a report on government services in Mali. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from France. England's Queen's Counsel, Kawar Koresh, has suffered a blow in Kenyan courts after lawyers representing Kenya's Deputy Chief Justice, Philomena Mwilu, opposed his appointment by Director of Public Prosecutions, Nuruddin Haji. There's a petition before the courts to determine whether Chief Justice Mwilu should face criminal charges, as Maureen Ojiambo reported. reports from Nairobi, Qureshi was outsourced by Haji after a number of cases facing government agency workers were thrown out by Kenyan judges.
The Queen's Counsel, Hawar Qureshi, was appointed by the Director of Public Prosecution, Nurdin Haji, early this week. Defending his move before the Senate Committee for Justice and Legal Affairs, Haji said the appointment of Counsel Qureshi is aimed at bringing to book high-profile persons involved in murder cases and misappropriation of billions of shillings in Kenya. He says Qureshi will lead the prosecutor's side in the case against the Deputy Chief Justice, Philomena Mwilu.
He's not coming here to handle corruption cases, all of them. He's coming for a particular case, and that is the case of the Deputy Chief Justice. And in my opinion, I felt that we needed an independent person who could be able to address the issues that are before the High Court.
Qureshi was said to represent the prosecutor in a case against Justice Philomena Mwilu yesterday, Thursday, when his work permit was questioned before the court proceedings by the prosecution. Justice Mwilu is being accused of abuse of office, tax evasion, and contribution towards the collapse of Imperial Bank of Kenya, which is under receivership. According to senior counsel James Orengo, who is representing Justice Mwilu, Qureshi cannot represent Mr. Haji in the case because he does not possess valid documents such as a certificate of admission allowing him to practice law in Kenya.
What I understood Mrs. Odoo to be doing is that Professor Qureshi has standing to appear before you, and on that basis, five pieces of documents were presented to the court and given to us outside the door here. We didn't have notice. We saw it for the first time. He is required to maintain a valid practicing certificate for the duration of the retainer. We have not been shown that.
Mr. Haji said in the petition that he wants the court to determine whether criminal prosecution of a sitting judge amounts to violation of the independence of the judiciary. Counsel Qureshi is, however, set to represent Haji in the cases against high-profile persons in Kenya once the case in High Court barring him from representing Mr. Haji will be heard and determined.
The qualifications that I possess in England entitle me to be admitted as a foreign advocate, and the Attorney General provided a letter of the 5th of December to that effect. The requisite fees were paid. I understand that the only thing that was left was for the relevant authority to provide a certificate, but the receipt to show that the fee had been paid was presented before the court.
The case that will determine whether Qureshi will participate in the case facing Justice Philomena Mwilu will be heard on 17th of January 2019. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The Zimbabwe government has started the process of compensating white commercial farmers displaced from their properties during the country's land reform in the early 2000s. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, farmers say the $53 million set aside for the purpose will not go far enough.
Zimbabwe's Commercial Farmers Union says it is waiting for details from the government on how it will compensate farmers whose property was seized during the country's land reform program beginning in 2000. Union Director Ben Gilpin welcomes the $53 million announced in the 2019 budget for the program with some reservations.
Generally, the amounts that people get are a fraction of what their properties are worth, and the amounts are spread over payments that take up to a number of years to complete. But it's a start and it's an acknowledgement. I think at the same time, the budget acknowledges that there's a bigger problem and the government needs to work to try and find a way around that.
The program seized the property from about 3,500 white commercial farmers and gave the land to blacks. Then President Robert Mugabe said the reform was necessary to correct injustices of the colonial period. Zimbabwe Minister of Finance Muturi Ncube says the $53 million is a stopgap measure while a figure is reached on how much is owed to all evicted farmers.
Zimbabwe is constitutional in its approach. Government is following that constitution, which is we agreed that we'll compensate the farmers in order to recognize the improvements and the investments they had made on that land. And we think that is just, that is fair, and that's what we'll be doing going forward.
Some farmers like Ben Frith would like to return to their former lands. Frith's family was forcibly removed from their Mount Carmel farm about 120 kilometers southwest of Harare in 2008. The farm has been reduced to a nearly wild forest, but Ben Frith said that could change.
And although they've taken away the main structure, the foundations are still here as well. The dams on the river are still there. The main pipelines, I think, are still there. The opened lands, although there's been a lot of regrowth of trees and things, they're essentially still there. It wouldn't take much to get this farm back productive once more.
Whether the return of white farmers to the land is acceptable to Zimbabwe's current president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, remains to be seen. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the confirmation that Kenya has qualified for the 2019 African Cup of Nations for the first time in 15 years, following the disqualification of Sierra Leone from the tournament by the Confederation of African Football, CAF. Football Kenya Federation President Nick Mwenwewa has said that the minimum target for Harambee Stars at the 2019 African Cup of Nations is to advance past the group stage.
If the Cup of Nations will be in the northern part of Africa, then we shall play in London against Jamaica, and also shall play another two or three matches in France against some West African sides, or against some African sides, so that we can build the team, and then we go to the Cup of Nations.
In Nigeria, the National Sports Festival got underway Thursday night in Abuja, the nation's capital, after 6 years of postponement. Over 8,000 athletes are expected to participate in a total of 37 sports during the games, which has a semblance with the Olympic Games. Solomon Dalong is Nigeria's Minister of Sports. In athletics news, marathon world record holder Eliud Kipchoge has been honored as the IWAF Male Athlete of the Year at Athletics Annual Awards Ceremony. Olympic champion Kipchoge shattered the world marathon record by 78 seconds as he completed the Berlin Marathon in 2 hours, 1 minute and 39 seconds.
First, I want to actually pass my gratitude to my family, my wife and my kids. These are the people who are actually my ignition key every morning when I am waking up to train.
In women's football, the Ghana Football Association Normalization Committee has reportedly paid the Black Queens of Ghana players their due bonuses after the end of the African Women Cup of Nations. Each player of the team reportedly got about $3,200 as participation fee for the event, which was won by Nigeria's Super Falcons. Dan Kweku Yeboah, spokesman for the Normalization Committee, said the allowances were paid to demonstrate the commitment the Normalization Committee had to the team.
Before the commencement of the tournament, the agreement was that the Black Queens were going to be paid qualification bonus. And so once they couldn't qualify to the next stage, the qualification bonus issue doesn't come in. What the ministry was owing them, which has been settled, was the per diem. The other monies that were given to the team were to serve as motivation.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, December 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Bott in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, an update on the U.S. political landscape. In 2019, Democrats are set to take over the majority in the lower chamber of Congress. How will they yield their newfound authority? What's the latest on the Russia probe and its impact on President Trump and the life and legacy of former President George H.W. Bush? That's Encounter on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a look at the recent release of political prisoners in Rwanda. U.S. lawmakers are pressing Rwanda's government against incarcerating a dissident politician. Those issues and more on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.